Thank you, Jackie, Sarah, everyone else for being here. Oh, and Alex for the scripture reading. Thank you. I procrastinated, so I had to use old material. So anyway, good morning, Sunday morning. It's good to see everybody here today. Thanks again for being here. We have a full audience even after the kids left. Today I want to talk about the sovereignty of God and talk about exactly how we might respond to it. The definition of sovereignty from the Oxford Languages, which is what Google uses by default, is given as supreme power or authority. Grok gives the definition as supreme power or authority. Grok gives sovereignty is a supreme authority and absolute rule of a governing power over a domain with no higher authority or external constraint. It's similar to our country's constitution regarding the laws that we have. If a state or a local government makes a law that contradicts what the Constitution says, a judge is supposed to rule that law unconstitutional, and then the Constitution supersedes the lesser. So when we talk about God's sovereignty, we're talking about his supreme authority and absolute rule over all the aspects of his creation. This includes nature itself, natural events, the nations, the people, and their politics that they kind of follow, I guess. They're the events that unfold in our lives, and then the way that they unfold, and different aspects of our individual lives. His authority over nature is clearly seen in the beginning from the creation. So in Genesis 1, we see it kind of portrayed perfectly. He spoke everything into existence. I know the picture's not right. He's painting it into existence there, but it's hard to draw somebody speaking something into existence. But this being kind of one of the main children's stories that come from the Bible, it can sometimes be easy to forget the implications of this, the power to create, to form something out of nothing, and just to speak and have reality obey your voice. So I think, although it's something we know, sometimes maybe we forget, or since we've heard it how many times, it's easy to kind of brush past it. This is sort of recounted, but a bit more poetically, in Psalm 104. Same picture. This passage recounts the creation from Genesis and goes on to show that God is God who sustains all life, that he's the provider. And if you were to read through this passage, to me at least, it makes it feel like he's continually involved in his creation. It's not a sovereignty that's either distant or detached, like he created everything and went away, or he's hands off watching what happens, but he's actively involved in it. And we can see this in several other passages. We have the story of Jesus calming the storm in Mark 4, verses 35 through 41. And through the authority given to him by God, verse 39 says, "And he, being Jesus, got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Hush, be still.' And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm." In Acts 5, the apostles, who had also earlier in the book been given authority, healed the sick. And beginning in verse 12 and going through 16, it reads, "The apostles performed many signs and wonders among the people, and all the believers used to be together in Solomon's colonnade. No one else dared join them, even though they were highly regarded by the people. Nevertheless, more and more men and women believed in the Lord and were added to their numbers. As a result, people brought the sick into the streets and laid them on beds and mats so that at least Peter's shadow might fall on some of them as he passed by. Crowds gathered also from the towns around Jerusalem, bringing their sick and those tormented by impure spirits, and all of them were healed. So here, with God's power, the apostles were in control of some the various things that were kind of impeding people's health, whatever that may have included. We can also see in Isaiah 38, 4 through 8. I don't know that I have this laid. Nope, just that. And that reads, "Then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, 'Go and tell Hezekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I have heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city. This is the Lord's sign to you that the Lord will do what he has promised. I will make the shadow cast by the sun go back the 10 steps it has gone down on the stairway of Ahaz.' So the sunlight went back the 10 steps it had gone down." And my point is showing his control over the natural, but it's here he's extended the life of Hezekiah, and he's at least presumably moved celestial bodies out of their normal orbit, I suppose, or however it happened. And you can probably think of example after example, but you kind of get the point that God is sovereign over the works of nature. Likewise, he has authority over the realm of mankind. And of course, we are also part of the creation, so it makes sense. He has authority over the nations and the leaders to do as he pleases. In Daniel 2, after Nebuchadnezzar had a troubling dream, he wanted his magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what his dream was and to provide an interpretation, otherwise they would be killed. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel, who in turn praises God. And looking at verses 20 in the first half of 21, we can read, he said, "Praise be the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others." He deposes kings and raises up others. He has authority over the governments of mankind. And it's emphasized again just a couple of chapters later. If we go to chapter 4 and look at verses 19 through 36. Again, Nebuchadnezzar had a troubling dream that his wise men couldn't interpret. And again, Daniel comes to the rescue. Nebuchadnezzar tells him the dream, and we read in verse 19. So this is 19 through 36. Oh, I have a slide for that. "Then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, 'Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you.' Belteshazzar answered, 'My lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. The tree which you saw, which grew large and strong, with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit, providing food for all, giving shelter to the wild animals and having nesting places in its branches for the birds. Your majesty, you are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion exceeds the distant parts of the earth. Your majesty saw a holy one, a messenger, coming down from heaven and saying, "Cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump, bound with iron and bronze, in the grass of the field, while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live with the wild animals until seven times pass for him." And then on to verse 24. This is the interpretation, your majesty, and this is the decree the Most High has issued against my lord, the king. You'll be driven away from the people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heavens rule. Therefore, your majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being king. Your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue. I guess I'm early in that slide a little bit. Then the dream is fulfilled in verse 28. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar 12 months later. As the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as a royal residence, but by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" And even as these words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You'll be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You'll eat grass like the ox. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately, what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from the people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. So even Nebuchadnezzar, I know it's a long reading, but it's a good example of God kind of putting a ruler, the most powerful ruler of that time, into place. So even someone as powerful as Nebuchadnezzar, my tongue is not working today, whom Daniel called the King of Kings, he was the head of pure gold from that first dream. He was nothing compared to God. He couldn't withstand the will of God. He thought in his pride that he had made something great, forgetting that it was actually God that had put him in power. And if we were to go back to chapter 2, 37 and 38, say, and this is from the first dream, "Your Majesty, you're the King of Kings." This is Daniel talking to Nebuchadnezzar. "Your Majesty, you're the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands, he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds in the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold." So knowing that, a couple chapters later, don't know the time span, it seemed to have been forgotten, and in his pride, he kind of took credit for what God had done. And for some variety, we'll turn to Proverbs 21:1, which reads, "In the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels toward all who please him." So God is in control of our leaders. If we look at Romans 13:1, it says, "Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." And then on to John. This is chapter 19, second part of 10, first part of 11. "Do you not know that this is Jesus speaking to Pilate when he's being questioned?" It's Pilate speaking to Jesus, "Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered in verse 11, You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. So even during times that it seems the ruler is not the greatest, from this example, we can see God is sovereign. He's still in control. Even though something evil was going on, Jesus said, you wouldn't have power if it wasn't given to you from God. So again, God's in control over the people's leadership. He's also sovereign and has authority over the people, the individuals. So not just nations, but us, me, you, on an individual level. And we can see this in Proverbs 19:21. It's written, "My plans are in a man's heart. Many plans are in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord will stand." And we can see this aside from other examples in the story of Joseph. In jealousy, his brothers sell him into slavery. And from there, he gets into the position of managing Potiphar's house. And then again, evil comes and he's falsely accused and he ends up in prison. And from there, through interpreting dreams, he eventually makes his way up to the second in command, just under Pharaoh, in the nation of Egypt. But later in Genesis 50, his concerned brothers confront him because his father had died, and they're kind of worried, we treated him poorly, what's going to happen to us? So if we look at verses 15 through 21, this is chapter 50 of Genesis. "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?' So they sent a message to Joseph saying, 'Your father charged before he died, saying, Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of your God, of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." So in this story, God was actively involved and in control of Joseph's situation. And I like the phrase, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." Because God can take an evil situation and reshape it into something good. It reminds me of the Silmarillion. Has anybody read that? I think my parents got it for me at one point. Mine was this cover. But this is a fictional story. Elves and people, the Tolkien world, whatever. But in this story, Tolkien, I don't even know how to say his name, writes of a sovereign godlike figure. I read Iluvatar, but sometimes I don't read things well. In fact, it was in high school, so I was old enough in class, and we were going through reading. The person before me had the word Yosemite. I'd never seen it written down, but I know like Yosemite Sam. But they got it before me, and they read it. It's like, oh, that makes sense. I'm glad I wasn't the one to get that. Like, Yosemite? I don't know what that is. Anyway, but in the story, there's the godlike figure, Iluvatar, that creates the world of Tolkien's literature. And this is done through music with angel-like characters. And the most powerful of those characters begins to rebel and begins to sow discord within the music. But Iluvatar, the creator figure, takes that discord and introduces a new musical theme that's soft, sorrowful, yet unbreakable, that didn't fight the discord, but kind of flowed around it and incorporated it. And it turned that chaos into something greater. It was pain that led to courage, loss that deepens joy, rebellion that heightens the triumph of harmony, and Melkor, that's the name of the angel-like creature that rebelled. So he doubled his discord, which symbolized ice, fire, darkness, the void, trying to dominate the song. Then Ulúvatar, the creator, stood a second time, his face turned. He raised his hand and with unyielding authority introduced the final overwhelming theme, simple, resolute, and triumphant. It did not silence Melkor, but contained him. Every discordant note was woven into the greater pattern. It turned to serve ends Melkor could not foresee. Storms that water the earth, fire that forges strength, darkness that makes light more precious. Ulúvatar says, "No theme may be played that hath not its uttermost source in me, nor can any alter the music in my despite. For he that attempteth this shall prove but mine instrument in the devising of things more wonderful, which he himself hath not imagined." And I kind of think this is Tolkien's interpretation of how a lot of churches see creation, but changed a little bit to fit his narrative. But I think it's the way he sees the relationship maybe between God and Satan or God and evil. And it's what I think of when I see evil intent turned into something good, like we just saw in Joseph's case. And we see this in the case of Jesus' death. If we look at Mark 15, verses 9 through 14, it reads, "Pilate answered them, saying, 'Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?' For he was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd and asked him to release Barabbas for them instead. Answering again, Pilate said to them, 'Then what shall I do with him whom you call the king of the Jews?' They shouted back, 'Crucify him!' But Pilate said to them, 'Why, what evil has he done?' But they shouted all the more, 'Crucify him!'" Here the religious leaders had him killed because he had exposed their corruption. He was a threat to their power. And so what they did was evil. But this evil fulfilled prophecy and became the path to our own salvation. God's sovereignty turns chaos into order. And here again, something that was evil into something that was very good. Acts 2, 23 through 24 goes like this. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him." And time is getting low, so we'll wrap this up. We've looked at God's sovereignty in different aspects of creation, and throughout some of those examples, with the examples that we saw, what should we do with this information? I mean, to know something and not do something, what's the point of that? God being sovereign should bring us a sense of peace and comfort. We don't need to be fearful like the disciples, like the fear they had in the stormy sea. We should have faith in God and in his authority over everything that's relating to us. We don't need to have concern over our basic needs. Matthew 6:33 tells us this. It says, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things," talking about our basic needs, "will be added to you." It's reminding me of the coin being taken from the fish to pay the temple tax. God provided when there was a need for it. Oh, not time for that one yet. Understanding that God is in control, we don't have to feel stressed about, now it's time for it, our own authorities. and the never-ending political chaos that we seem to be in. Whether you love Trump and wear his red hat, or you recite each night that the orange man is bad, he'll serve God. He'll serve God's purpose, I should say. And we should pray for our leaders, whether we like them or don't dislike them. And we can see that in 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4, which says, First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God, our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. God's sovereignty brings a sense of humility with it as we realize that we as individuals or as a people collectively, we're not gods, even though sometimes it seems like it's portrayed that way, like we're in control of something. When we see that God is the one that's truly in control, we can see that we should bend our will towards His will be unmovable for us. So it's us that need to change to follow him. He's not going to change to follow us. Even Bob Dylan wrote in his song, the song Ain't No Man Righteous, No Not One. He says, God got the power, man has got his vanity. Man got to choose before God can set him free. So it's our choice to align our will to his. It's as simple as that. God is sovereign over each of our lives and the circumstances that we find ourselves in, and this allows us peace through trust and to be joyful of passages like Romans 8:28 that read, and we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. We can remember Job's example. And there God turned something evil into something good. We can know that God is able to deliver us from the evils of this world if he is willing. And if he's not willing, then an evil is victorious over this life, which happened throughout the Bible and even afterward. You see people who are Christians still be victim of evil. And so even if that's the case, he's still in control. We can have peace knowing that his reward comes later. And this is because he's the author of the world, and he's the one that's in control of everything. He's writing the story of time, and because of this, he deserves our worship and our praise. And we can do that with our last song, Miss Jacqueline.